Hello and welcome aboard this podcast of RTÉ Radio 1's maritime programme Seascapes, which is presented and produced by Marcus Connaughton. You can email the programme seascapes@rte.ie. Hello and welcome aboard this week's edition of your maritime programme Seascapes. We bring you further fishy tales this week and the results of our competition for copies of The Fishmonger by Pat O'Connell, courtesy of the Liffey Press. We'll have a further helping of Irish Shipping, A Fleet History. The authors are John Boyce, Brian Clear, Brian Boyce and Leo Coy. Seascapes spoke with Brian Clear and Leo Coy, and we take up the story of the content of this beautifully produced record of an historic shipping line with Brian Clear.
This is very much a fleet history, in as much as we detail the lives and stories of each one of the ships, from the first one to the Irish Poplar, right up to the last ship that was built in Verlone, in Rushbrook, the Irish Spruce, and even onto the ships that they chartered that eventually broke the company. But we concentrated on the history of the ships as opposed to the business side of the company.
Would you have a favourite vessel out of them? I know it's like asking a father to pick a favourite child, particularly given the fact that you're as familiar as you are with all of them, but is there one that sticks out for you?
The second Irish Oak. Herself and her sister ship, the Irish Pine. They had the lines of ocean-going yachts. They were fine-looking ships, good seaboats, and brought the company through a difficult time in the 1950s.
In one section of the book, we've got a ship, and we've listed what it was, the Irish Elm. And I'll just read you what the cargo consisted of. 4,500 tonnes of grain, 512 tonnes of paper pulp, 304 tonnes of tobacco, 169 tonnes of constructional steel, 140 tonnes of cardboard, 135 tonnes of asbestos fibre, 80 tonnes of fibre for brushes, 55 tonnes of printing paper, 15 tonnes of silicon for steel tempering, 14 tonnes of fibre board, 11 tonnes of petroleum jelly, 8 tonnes of nails, 7 tonnes of vegetable seeds, 6 tonnes of machinery for cleaning seeds, and 8 tonnes of beeswax. In addition, there were 37 tonnes of sundry items, including x-ray equipment parts, ladies' corset supports, very important, medicines and machinery parts. So that's amazing, isn't it? Amazing.
To keep a ship going, you needed the office staff. You needed office staff in Dublin, you needed in Waterford, you needed in Cork, Galway, everywhere where the ships were running. And each ship now had its crew, but it also had its relief crew. So you're talking about a crew and a half for each ship. So there was an awful lot of people involved. And the people who supplied the ships with foods, with oil, all these people got, you know, they were all had their fingers in the pie.
And of course we forget that ship's chandlers were all around the country at one stage. Now you'd have to search out a ship's chandlers to try and find them, and you might not necessarily be on the quayside where you'd expect to find them.
Their business has changed. I think it's more towards the leisure industry now, very much so. They've had to change with the changing pattern of shipping. Because most of the ships now, there's very, very few ships now get supplied or stored in Ireland now, because it's probably cheaper somewhere else to get.
Leo Coy explained to Seascapes how you can source a copy of this fleet history.
Well, they can get their hands on it by contacting us, the Rosslare Maritime Enthusiasts, or in most good bookshops now they'll find it, certainly in the book centres in Waterford and Wexford. In the National Maritime Museum in Dublin, it'll be in the Arklow Maritime Museum, and it will be in our own Maritime Museum in Rosslare Harbour, so that will be available there.
One of the main contributors and helped us an awful lot of the book was the Port of Cork, and we would really like to thank the Port of Cork Authority. The printers, Creative Design of Wexford, a gentleman by the name of Noel Moore, he helped us out an awful lot with the book. And, well, Leo,
can you think? Port of Dublin as well.
Port of Dublin, yeah.
And our co-authors, Brian Boyce and John Boyce, And Sean Boyce, Captain Sean Boyce as well, he did a lot of work in the last few months on editing and proofreading. And
several stories throughout the book that different people have contributed, like Captain Michael Coleman tells of a story of a trip on the Irish Poplar to Tahiti. Another gentleman tells a story of the going to join the Irish Elm, the last Irish Elm, on a maiden voyage. So another one is a story of the Irish joining the Irish Hawthorn in Germany. So there's lots of stories like that in the book. Like, you know, I've had an interest in ships ever since I was small, and we've developed the interest into collecting. I've collected pictures from all over the place now for Irish shipping. For the book, got a lot from very good friends like Terry Conlon in Dublin, Joey Teasdale in Dunmore East, you know, just to mention a few. My daughter Grania, she helped an awful lot with the typing and the book. It's an outlet for my interest. It was through this book.
I got hooked on the World Concord Rescue. That was it, and then a group of us got together, and we all worked so well together. And I lived by the sea all my life. So I've got a great interest in what comes in and out of Rosslare Harbour. And I worked for Irish Ferries for Shoreside for about 8 years. So I've grown up with ships, and I love it all. And it's a labour of love.
There's over 440 photographs in the book, of which 100 plus are in colour. There's 350 odd pages, and it's hardback. It's a good, it's a substantial book. And like I say, it will be available at all good bookshops.
Irish Shipping: A Fleet History is available from Rosslare Maritime Enthusiasts and in select bookstores throughout the country. We heard there from two of the four authors, Brian Clear and Leo Coy. And we've had a note from listener Liam O'Riordan in Blackrock in Dublin, who writes, "I vividly recall the wild, wet winter's night when the Irish plane was driven ashore in a southwesterly gale at Ballyshane near Ballycotton. I was an 8-year-old in our family home in Ballycotton when an older cousin, John O'Riordan, dressed in yellow oilskins, rushed in and excitedly told us that the plane was on the rocks. John was heading to Ballyshane with the Ballycotton rocket crew, who subsequently brought the ship's crew to safety using their breeches buoy. We had a number of discarded Irish plane life jackets in our home for many years afterwards. 11 years later, I became an Irish Shipping navigating cadet and joined my first ship, the New Irish Plane, in Purfleet on the 16th of December 1958, before spending Christmas on a rough Atlantic bound for Halifax, Nova Scotia. I was back on board the Irish Plane later when it entered dry dock in Dublin and was renamed the Dhaka City, being one of the first ships purchased by Bangladesh." Liam continues, "I later served on the Irish Oak and the Irish Spruce before being appointed third mate on the smaller Irish Rose, which, despite her size, traded on the North Atlantic as well as around European ports. When fully loaded with Canadian timber in an Atlantic gale, being on the Irish Rose was an exciting experience, with big green ones washing over the decks. We had a close call in a fierce January storm in the English Channel when a collier foundered near us in a huge seas, and our cargo of 20 tons of steel moles broke loose, slid around the hold and threatened to puncture the hull. We made it safely to shelter in Torbay, and the crew of the collier were rescued from their lifeboat by an Antarctic survey ship, which fortunately was in the area." Liam was lucky enough to do a circumnavigation on the Irish Spruce, and was also on the Spruce when they were one of the first salties, that's deep sea ships to you and I, to traverse the St. Lawrence Seaway from Montreal to Duluth in Minnesota, where they were given a tremendous welcome with their crew adopted by the strong Polish community. As they passed Quebec homeward bound down the St. Lawrence River, they met the Royal Yacht Britannia heading upriver with Queen Elizabeth and President Eisenhower on their way to officially open the seaway. Liam finishes by saying he got married in 1962 and decided to give shore life a try by joining Lloyds Bank, where he later transferred to an embryonic computer department, which eventually brought him to Dublin and AIB. He donated his sextant to the National Maritime Museum in Dunleary, where it's regularly on display. Our thanks to Liam O'Riordan for sharing those memories with us here on Seascapes. Next to the author of The Fishmonger, Pat O'Connell, who talked to us about the English market and that much publicised meeting with the Queen of England on her state visit.
Sometime last year, somebody was visiting from France and they made a point of coming in because they were terribly proud of this photograph that they had of their patisserie in Paris. The Queen has visited at some stage. And of course, I said, yeah, lovely photograph and everything. But going through my head at the time was, oh my God, disaster. Because this guy was standing behind the counter showing off the cakes and the delicacies and whatever. And the Queen of England was standing probably 10 yards back, 15 yards back, holding her handbag in front of her with a terribly bland, bored look on her face. And I was thinking, that could so easily have happened here had we not been able to get out and get really close, pick up the fish. And let's not forget, at the end of the day, it was all about fish for me particularly, because, you know, Castle Lumbier have been very good to us in the last 50 odd years. They've been a tremendous co-op to us. I could never say enough about John Nolan and his predecessors. And I suppose it's probably been a bit selfish in some ways, but to me it was just such a wonderful chance to show off to the rest of the world. And, you know, I mean, Europe knows we have fish, but this was going out all over the world. This was going to be everywhere. And to be able to pick up huge prawns, crab, lobster, hake, gurnard, monkfish, lemon sole, just glistening. To be able to tell her about the fish that was caught that morning at 6:30 in the River Lee. You know, we're a city. Two tributaries of the Lee running through the heart of the city. And yet we can have these fantastic wild salmon coming up in immaculate condition. Stunning, stunning fish. And to be able to tell her it was caught at 6:30 that morning. It was caught by Simon Quilligan. You know, it's a wild Atlantic salmon. And it comes from our river, which is only a couple of yards from here. It's a fabulous thing to be able to say to somebody from abroad that, you know, counselling their wisdom a few years ago, cleaned up all the river, and, you know, the fish has been just so amazing since. That was one of the really surprising things about it. I think Cork people kind of stuck out their chests and said, yeah, this is Cork. Like, this is just, wow, like, we've got this on our doorstep and we've kind of been taking it for granted for so long. And I think, yeah, I think they kind of had a huge pride in the way the English market showed itself and showed Cork on that particular day. Now, it's been doing it since for 300 years every day. But I think on that particular day, for some reason, people took a little bit of more notice, shall we say. But like, there were people on Patrick Street, apparently, and they were cheering like as she was walking through the market. There was people on the Grand Parade, like, and there was, it was just incredible scenes. Like, it was like Cork had won the All-Ireland again, you know. It was fantastic. One of the families we'd have been friendly with when we go to Gary Vaux would have been the Toomeys. And Ross Toomey was one of the lads that was across on the Grand Parade, and Ross put his two arms out, and Ross is now known as Royal Ross, of course, being Cork. But it was, yeah, I mean, it was that welcome, and it was the fact that she felt so at ease in Cork and so relaxed after Pat O'Connell, obviously, that she thought she could go across the street and give a big hug to anybody that wanted it, and no bad.
Now, you still obviously keep in touch with Buckingham Palace, and I mean, this book is going to be a wonderful memento for people visiting the market.
Well, that's not what it was written for. And a funny story about how the book came about, because I had no intention of writing a book, if I tell the truth. But there was a girl called Tricia Hearn, who's written The Lightkeeper and another one or two books, rang me, I think, way back in January. I said, could she write a book on me? And I said, what the hell do you want to write a book on Pat O'Connell for when you sell fish? And she said, I think there's a story in it. So anyway, we chatted for a while and said, yeah, sure, okay, why not? The real reason, I suppose, if I tell the truth, is that I kind of thought something needs to be written about Kathleen. And that was the driving force behind it, if I tell the truth. This book was about kind of the market and about my side of it. So, yeah, I mean, for that, they were just incredible people. No words of mine would ever praise them enough, or nothing I could ever do would give them the thanks that I need to give them, I'll be honest. Probably when Paul and myself were at our most desperate, I suppose, realistically, these people appeared and just took everything into their hands and took us by the hand and led us along a very nasty road, but they made it an awful lot easier than what it could have been. You know, Sister Marcella, Sister Nen, oh, the list goes on. They're just incredible, dedicated, passionate, caring, loving people. Could never say enough about them. And the proceeds that I make on this book goes towards Marymount. I think the cooking has come on in Ireland just so, so much. And I don't know, is it people travelling abroad and seeing, you know, different ways of doing dishes? But like when I look back in the 70s, there was very little appetite for adventure or for trying different foods or for... No, no matter what we bring in. We've had mahi-mahi, we've had rabbit fish, we've had orange roughy. And people try it and they come back and they tell you, nah, I didn't like that or that was great. And Saturdays is fascinating because Saturdays is mostly male. And like, you know, you think, God. And they're passionate, like they want the best of everything and they want to know why is that better than this or... And that's all changed from way back when I started, because it was all women in those days. And, you know, they came in and they said, you know, 3 mackerel, 2 whiting or a pound of smoked haddock. No, on Saturdays particularly, people come in and say, what's good today, Pat? And to me, like, that's a huge compliment. Like, I just love when people say that because that means, you know, they trust you. And to me, it just shows as a nation how confident we've become with fish. And again, I go back to the 70s and I say, oh God, why wasn't there more of our government or our ministers tuned into the potential? Because I think now all of a sudden we have this, what we now recognise as an extremely valuable resource off our coast. And we're very limited in how we can get our hands on it.
Now, the inevitable question. She had a great laugh when she was here. Inevitably, of course, it's the cover of the book, The Fishmonger by Pat O'Connell, published by the Liffey Press. The two of you have struck up your pen friends. Would that be fair to say?
I think it would be fair to say, yeah. I think she had a wonderful, wonderful time in Cork. It just wouldn't really matter because she didn't understand me anyway with a Cork accent. Honestly, we had so many laughs. I mean, we laughed about the mother-in-law fish, or what we call the mother-in-law fish in Cork, and we were laughing at Gornard. And then, of course, there was my wedding anniversary being that week, and I tell her that I hadn't been that nervous in 30 years. But we just seemed to hit it off. And on the day, that was the gamble, because I wasn't sure what the woman was like. I didn't know whether she had a sense of humour or not. If she did, things were going to be okay. If she didn't, I was in serious trouble because I'd be laughing and she'd be there with a frown on her face, and I think it would have just given the totally wrong impression. And to me, the fact that we were that close to her, that we had a really nice chat and a really, really good laugh, obviously. And I think she just was absolutely fascinated at being treated as a very ordinary person at a fish stall or at any stall in the market, really, is that, you know, there was no protocol, there was no, you know, I'm very proud of this country. I think, you know, we're a very well-educated people. I'm very proud of our independence. And to me, you know, history has its place, but in a lot of ways it's a different nation. And I think it's nice that we can make our own little bit of history and move things on, hopefully. You know, we have a lot more in common than we argue about.
Pat O'Connell is dedicated to his craft.
Oh, God, what inspires me, Marcus? I often ask myself that early in the morning when I'm going into a really cold market. I'm saying, why, Pat, why? I love Cork City, as anybody that knows me. No, I just love the banter, I love the crack, I love the sense of fun that we have down here and the way that we can laugh at each other. I love the English market in Cork because I think, to me, it's the cultural centre of Cork. I think it's where you get a total mix of every walk of life in Cork City, from poor to rich, from, you know, every type of Corkman comes into the English market. They all love it. It's just so much part of our culture. It survived fires, recessions, depressions, floods, and it just seems to keep on fighting its way through all these things. And it is a fight because you have huge competition these days from outside. And it just still survives and it keeps changing. And, you know, I mean, when I was writing the book, I look back at photographs from 1957, 58. And I kind of said, like, God, how did this place survive back then? Because there was tarmacadam floors, no refrigeration, you know, water everywhere, mess everywhere. And yet it was thriving. And you look at it now and you'd say, God, it's changed. And yet it hasn't, Marcus, because the product is still very much the same. It's still fantastic arrays of fish, fabulous meat, fantastic veg. But now we have the little additions of things like olive stalls and fantastic cheeses. And it's just so vibrant. And I don't know, do I sound like I love the place?
Almost. I think your psychiatrist's work is almost complete. One of the wonderful passages in the book is your description of all the turkeys. And I suppose we're coming into that kind of time of the year now. Whereas you don't see those kind of displays of birds hanging off the hooks. But that really comes to life in the pages of this book. But also, there's a lovely shot of yourself and your father and your mum in Moore Street. Obviously, your mum was doing some field research on a trip to find out what the ladies in Moore Street, how they were managing their fish stocks.
Yeah, no matter where you went, mother did a field trip. Everywhere she went, she did a field trip. And you were always told what that guy was doing wrong or what this guy was doing wrong or what she was saying wrong or, you know, she was just absolutely legend woman. I mean, she was so far ahead of her time. I mean, you see Fergal Quinn and he talked about, you know, customer service, and Kathleen O'Connell, I think, was just so far ahead of Fergal Quinn in her day. And on top of that, like, just a fabulous worker. But I mean, you know, when she, no matter where she was, any shop she ever went into, she kind of summed up in 2 seconds what the staff was like, what the shop was like, and she just had a feel for it. And like Kathleen could serve 3 customers together and every one of them was entertained and every one of them felt, you know, I don't want to go away from here a while. Like, it's always a crack. And the market is still the same today. I mean, it's what makes it, like, kind of, as we say, over, like, owner-occupier, you know, over-the-counter kind of sales. You know, if people coming into me that would have started 50 years ago with my mum, like, or their mother would have been 50 years ago, or their grandmother would have been in 50 years ago. And that kind of history and that kind of tradition is just so inbuilt into the market as such. And then you get the nice new stalls, like the olive stall or whatever that comes along. I laugh now because the olive stall is actually 20 years old last week, but I mean, that's still new in the scale of the market. And they kind of come in and they pick up on the vibes and they pick up on the atmosphere. And it is ferocious work. I mean, you know, we start at 6:30, whatever. We get out at 6:45 in the evening. And unless you love it, like, don't be there. It's, you know, I've seen many fellas turn into drink or whatever down through the years because they just don't want to be there. But if you do want to be there, you couldn't be in a better place. Kathleen would always tell us, if you're enjoying your work, it's not work, it's a hobby. Of course, the other side of that, like, is every passion has a price. And, you know, you need a very understanding woman at home, or, you know, you need understanding kids, because, you know, I know when my kids were younger, I missed out on stuff that, you know, you only get one chance to ever see, really. And that's the expensive side of it. It's not your time. But you do miss out on things and you do really need somebody. And, I mean, I'm very lucky with Margaret. I mean, we're married 33 years now, I think. Even though it seems a few hours, really. You know, she's always backed me in what I want to do. She knows I love what I do. You know, we have a good life out of it. But there's no doubt when you put in that kind of work and those kind of hours and that kind of dedication, you know, it's a team effort. It's not about Pat O'Connell. It's a team effort. Well, I always say that Ireland has probably the best food in the world. I really don't think of many places that has any better. And I suppose that with a setup like the English market, you have a showcase for that food. And I suppose when it's on your doorstep, you tend to take it very much for granted. You become a little bit blasé about it. And, you know, I mean, we see it now with a lot of English tourists these days who come over and they come through and they say, God, like, we used to have a market like this once. And, like, it wasn't so long ago, Marcus. I mean, back in the 70s, the English market was under really serious threat. And I'm not sure people realise how close it came to being in big trouble. I mean, a lot of the traders that they had to, or that time, had to go over and canvass councillors and canvass city council and saying, lads, wake up, you know, this, it's in trouble and you're going to have to bail it out and help it out.
Pat O'Connell of Face of Cork and author of The Fishmonger. As we mentioned in our competition last week, we have a handful of copies of The Fishmonger, courtesy of the Liffey Press, and we asked you to tell us the alternative name for monkfish that we mentioned last week in our introduction to Pat, the answer being mother-in-law fish. We had the biggest response of the year, and the lucky winners of signed copies of The Fishmonger are Francis Kelleher in Longford, Pascal Lyons in Ballintemple in Cork, Raymond O'Connor in Kildymo in County Limerick, and Nuala Higgins in Mullingar. Those copies will be with you in the coming days. Gillian Mills was in touch to let us know that this Saturday she'll be showing a selection of images from the remarkable 50th anniversary celebrations that took place over three glorious days in June of the Old Gaffers Association. You can see all these images in the Poolbeg Boat and Yacht Club at 3 o'clock in the afternoon on this Saturday. The eighth edition of the Ireland Tide Tables for 2014 has just been published by Maps and Charts and is available in selected retail outlets all around the coast. It's a must-have for all seafarers and those whose lives and property are affected by sea and tides. Next Friday night here on Seascapes, we'll be talking to the Chief Executive of Concern, Dominic McSorley, on the plight of fishermen in the Philippines following Typhoon Haiyan and how they're rebuilding their lives and their fishing fleet. We hear from photographer Nigel Millard with the RNLI, and we've a signed copy of the lifeboat Courage on Our Coasts in our Seascapes competition. Hugh Oram talks to us about the treasured fruit that bananas were being carried in the captain's cabin, and Robert Dunn on the remarkable story of survival by his great-grandmother, Elizabeth McNair, aboard the Swan, with the renowned Southern Syncopated Orchestra. All that and much more here on Your Maritime Programme. Until next Friday night, here on Seascapes, Tight Lines and Fair Sail.